Well, welcome to The Food Professor, episode number 2. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Sylvain Charlebois.
Well, Sylvain, it's another week. Let's jump right in. I'm so impressed by the amount and the quality and quantity of research you do in these, you know, very interesting times. So let's, as I said, let's jump right into the latest research. I called it slamming the farm gate behind us. Let's talk about the research you did with...
That's one way to put it.
you did with cattle, agri-food, analytics lab, of course, at Dalhousie University, research on COVID-19, food security, and euthanizing animals. Now, before you tell us about the research, tell us about who Cattle is, your research partner. Just give us some context for who they are and how they get their information.
Yeah, Cato is a firm out of St. Catharines, Ontario, and they approached us to do some work together. And they're a very young firm, but they've done some work privately with some labels like Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and they wanted to engage with us and do some data collection. And they work the same way as other firms in the country that are well known. We do have a partnership with Angus Reid, and that's continuing. In fact, we're actually doing a study right now on the food service sector, and that's with mm-hmm. Angus Reid. We basically explored the issue of farm gate waste with Cato, and we came up with some really interesting results. The issue of farm gate waste is a very sensitive one for farming, right? Because as soon as you admit that there is waste, you're admitting that there are failures within the system, especially when it comes to supply and management. And very few universities are willing to look at that issue intentionally. But that's our job at the lab. That's our job, our team. What we do is that we look at things that nobody else wants to look at that are very important to Canadians.
Not only in the context of farm gate waste, and to the listeners defining that is, you know, in the livestock, you're euthanizing livestock so they don't get to the processor. And we've been reading about these shocks to the supply system. But interestingly, because of this shift from food service to home-based consumption that we're all doing, things are different, right? So I was reading, for example, that bacon sales are way, way down because, and at first I'm like, how can that be? And then I realized most bacon, I guess, is consumed, you know, in restaurants or on your burger or something, and people just don't make bacon. So what you wind up with is a big surprising surplus of livestock that just has nowhere to go, right? I mean,
absolutely. I don't think it's ever been as obvious as now. The consumer walking into a grocery store, it's just not the same person as the person you would find in a restaurant. We consume different things. Think about chicken wings, fries, and you just mentioned bacon. Absolutely. Those are all examples. That's why there's been surpluses here and there. And unfortunately, we've had to throw away commodities, perfectly good food, essentially, and unfortunately, there's been reports of euthanasia at farm gate, and that's really just the worst, and that's a black eye that I suspect vegan groups will take a note of. In fact, every other day, I see now an op-ed from a vegan group basically pointing fingers at the industry, saying, "Well, there's a problem with our model right now, and livestock production may not be sustainable over the long term." And they do have a point, which is really our concern as a group over at the lab. I mean, the livestock industry is a very strong industry and provides high quality food to Canadians and other consumers around the world, and their image is being affected by what's happening.
And it seemed like, as I read the research, there's two issues. One is just the waste, right? So people are just saying there's people who are in need and we're actually euthanizing animals. And then the second part is just the killing of animals for no purpose, like the moral issue. And which of those, if one stood out? I mean, I see, you know, and it's different by what, you know, it's different for milk than it is I see for hogs and pigs, right? 48% of Canadians felt that discarding milk should be illegal. So we'll get to that whole, what do you do about it? And then, but 53% said it should be illegal when you're euthanizing livestock. So even there's a qualitative difference in the people's judgment, I guess, right?
Oh, absolutely. But even with milk, there are issues. When you understand how dairy genetics work, I mean, you're basically getting a cow to produce 10 times the milk she would normally produce without the genetics or without impregnating the animal artificially. And so there's also that notion that milk is being produced for nothing, really. So it's being dumped. I know that farmers really feel bad about what's happening right now.
But Yeah.
But the point of the study is that perhaps we need to think strategically about surpluses. And I'm not sure we've done that all that well. With supply management, mechanisms are in place already in order for different sectors to properly manage surpluses. Milk, for example, you can actually look into bioenergy. You can look at producing different types of products with milk. You can redirect milk. You can build up the reserve that the Canadian Dairy Commission actually has. They have a strategic reserve already. The Trudeau government actually has provided an extra $200 million to for the CDC, and that's going to be helpful. But we've never been strategic because, and I'll be honest with you, Michael, I'm not sure that agriculture has been very comfortable talking about it, whether it's with the public or amongst themselves. It is a recurring issue. This is not new. COVID just made the problem much more obvious. But surpluses have been around for decades. There's been reports of milk dumping and milk lagoons all over the country for decades. But we've never really looked into the issue very seriously. With livestock, same thing. I mean, I grew up in Farnham, Quebec, in rural Quebec, and I saw all sorts of things going on when I was growing up. Only later I realized what actually it meant. It meant wasting perfectly good food. That what makes me even more uncomfortable is our StatCan's number that actually came out last week. For example, potatoes. We actually have a glut of potatoes, 300 million pounds of potatoes. Wow. Still, potato prices at retail are up 11%. Eggs, we had to discard 2 million eggs in Canada. That was the report that was provided by egg producers in Quebec. Egg prices are up 7% retail. So
it'll be a good segue, because the next thing we're going to talk about, this bun fight going on between how are those prices going up when there's such surpluses.
That's why there is a huge disconnect between what consumers deal with in the store and what goes on at Farmgate.
So, you know, you brought up a really interesting issue, and we'll kind of close on this, and then the final, you know, so to speak, recommendations of the survey, is that I would think any industry, to be, you know, 100% fair, is, you know, having to adjust to the shocks and very different changes of consumption, and that this would all level out in the fullness of time. It could be months, but eventually surpluses and euthanasia would go away, just because people would start, oh, I'll just raise less animals because I know there's less demand. But what you're saying is it's not a new issue, and it's something that needs to be dealt with. And you talk about a possible solution, because it comes up this point of illegality, and you seem to be thinking that might be one way to proceed to make the dumping of this product of supply managed commodities actually illegal. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so in supply management, if you understand the principles of supply management, you basically produce what you need. And in order to produce these commodities commercially, you need to own quotas. And those quotas are sanctioned by our governments. In a nutshell, milk, chicken, and eggs, all of these commodities operate under supply management, are public goods, really. And if you make it illegal to dump or to waste these commodities at Farmgate, you are forcing the entire supply chain to work together. And you can actually work on better vertical coordination. And that's what's missing right now, because right now supply management is dividing the value chain. You have farmers dealing with their issues. You have processors that dealing with their issues. They're not working together, which is something you would see, say, in countries like Denmark or the Netherlands. With non-supply management, I'm not with like pork, for example, or beef, I'm not sure I would go as far, because it is a free market, and it's always difficult to absorb a shock like COVID. Yes, we actually did euthanize pigs, chickens as well in Canada, or pigs. It's not an easy thing to accept, but the shock was pretty big. But yeah. China has a strategic reserve for pork. Why not have one for us as well?
And it's a different subject, but China, you know, went through a massive crisis in their pork, right? With what was it, the swine fever?
Oh, it's still going on.
It's still decimated the pork.
Absolutely. And they have a 6-month reserve, and they use it very wisely. And but China is a highly regulated, coordinated economy. Don't think we should do the same in Canada. But when it comes to commodities, if we are to appreciate the work of our farmers, I think we need to be strategic about surpluses moving forward.
Let's leave it there. Now, you've got some more research that you're, I believe, going into field with today that we'll talk about on the next podcast. Give us a 30-second snapshot of what you're researching this week.
Well, we're at the very beginning of what I would see as an economic recovery in Canada. And of course, restaurants are gearing up, and some provinces we are seeing restaurants or the food service industry opening up a little bit. We're surveying Canadians in terms of when they plan to show up. When are they comfortable going out? And if so, when are they planning to go out? And if not, why? What type of restaurants are going to be visiting? Are there restaurants they're going to probably try to avoid more so than others? Those are the type of questions we're asking. And of course, we're also asking what they're expecting, what kind of environment and service they're expecting as well. They're expecting slow service. Are they expecting a lot of plexiglass masks? Because of course, when you go to a restaurant, the environment and the service are key components.
Yeah.
And it's hard not to see how COVID could compromise these two very important elements.
Well, I've seen pictures, and it's almost like they're made up, but of people in Holland eating in glass. They look like glass greenhouses by the water. That's a lot of work to go have a meal together. But
yeah, you feel like a rat. In the lab.
All right. Well, we'll leave that there, and that'll be great to learn all about on our next episode.
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned something that I wanted to dive into. I'll call it a bun fight. You know, Stats Canada tells us the cost of the center aisle and other commodities are going up. You know, Michael Graydon from the FCPC represents the manufacturers, say, listen, our members don't set pricing. Retail Council of Canada says, Deanne Brisebois and her team say, listen, the retail's haven't raised prices, but Stats Can tells us, you know, baked beans up 19%, canned tomatoes up 19%, carrots 14%, canned soup 12%, bathroom tissue up, you know, 12%. What's going on here? Is there a different, you know, both sides are saying, listen, we're not raising prices, but Stats Canada is saying on some commodities the prices are going up. What do you think is going on here?
It's a different world. A different world is emerging. And so when you look at inflation data, clearly prices are going down everywhere. We're at minus 0.2 now, but fruit prices are standing out. I mean, it's at 3.4%. And that's why I do expect pre-COVID, there were tensions, and you know this, Michael, there were tensions between distributors and processors. I actually think it's going to get worse. Just because of the fact that you have, on the one side, the inflation rate being very, very low, being in the negatives, in fact, while you're seeing the food inflation rate being at almost 4%. And so that's going to attract a lot of attention, a lot of bad attention, I would say. And people within the supply chain will probably start pointing fingers. And that's kind of what we're seeing right now, which is unfortunate, because at the end of the day, what really is happening is that, well, the food industry is a high volume, low margin business. That's essentially what it is. And there's not much room to play with, to absorb extra costs. And COVID is increasing costs for everyone from farm gate to plate. And so when I saw the numbers coming out of stats, yeah, I wasn't surprised. In fact, we were pretty close to what we were predicting. And the numbers were pretty close to what we were predicting.
Which is about 4%, right, at a macro level.
You were thinking, and that's where we're going. And I suspect we'll get to that 4% by the end of this year. The problem is that for 2021, 2022, I suspect we're going to still probably be at around 4% while everything else gets cheaper. So in other words, you're asking everyone to spend more on food relative to their budget. And so that's going to hurt a little bit, and especially it's going to hurt fat households where you find people who've lost their jobs, unfortunately. So the environment is going to be very, very tough for the next little while. But I would say, really, with the numbers we saw, there's a lot of inflation in the middle of the store, or there was a lot of inflation in the middle of the store. A lot of these products are imported, in fact. But those products were very popular at the beginning of the pandemic. Yeah. But I suspect that over time, that inflation will impact the periphery of the store. All the fresh stuff and produce would be one. And you'll probably see, meat has been affected by inflation as well since the beginning of the year. And that's going to continue as well. So there's lots of different categories which are going to be affected by food inflation.
Well, I mean, and talking to retailers, this whole stock up that we saw in the early days of COVID is just another distortion of their supply chain model because, you know, I have to admit, I have enough toilet paper to last till probably November. So, you know, you've got this, you know, I look at baked beans, I bought about a case of 24 baked beans. I don't go through a lot of baked beans. So, you know, you've got another distortion in the supply chain because now suddenly things are just going to, you know, stock up. Let's move on. Let's talk about a half-baked idea. I was listening to the Monk School. They had the Monk debates, and Janice Stein from the Monk School came on and said they were talking about at the time something we talked about last episode was the pandemic processing plants, and she said, "Listen, they should and can move almost to 100% digital robots." Is this a fantasy or is there some reality? I see the pictures of how, you know, hands-on, shoulder-to-shoulder, you know, tough work it is in the meat processing sector. Can it be robotic?
Probably, I would say. I mean, there are going to be different models emerging. And as I mentioned several times the last 10 weeks, a lot of people are condemning our current model. It's too centralized. It's too concentrated. And to a certain extent, those people are right. But at the same time, they're probably aiming at the wrong problem, which is size. I don't think size is the problem. It's management.
Yeah, you made that point on social media. I forget what the exact context was, but basically, smaller processing plants are not the answer. Better processing plants are the answer.
Exactly. And I've been saying it for years. We've done some studies on this issue in a couple of provinces. And I gotta tell you, Michael, I mean, I've been to very small abattoirs and I wouldn't eat anything coming out of there, like ever, because they just... food safety was an issue. Everything was paper-based. They had no idea what was going on. A lot of them have actually shut down. In fact, actually, we did a study a few years ago looking at over 100 different abattoirs that have closed to understand why they closed. And most of the owners, operators, were blaming regs.
Yeah, compliance issues, as we would call them.
Compliance issues, that's exactly. And so that was our hypothesis coming in. But once we actually submitted our report, we realized that really it boiled down to bad decisions and management and not knowing enough about financials. So just to answer your question about robotics, I mean, I do see a role in meat packing for robotics and AI, but you need to invest. And that requires a lot of capital. Mm. And so would Cargill be willing to do that, given the low margins and the uncertainty and the cyclical nature of the business? I don't know. Same for GBS Canada. And these companies are very, very private.
Sure.
And so I would see... Now, look at Maple Leaf, for example. Maple Leaf has done a pretty good job modernizing its plants. I mean, look at Hamilton and look at what's going on in London. I mean, all of these investments are making a case for more robotics and more AI.
And
so it's going to be very interesting to watch.
It feels like, you know, there's external shocks that often cause these big changes to happen. There certainly was one with Maple Leaf Foods. Maybe for the Cargill, it must not be easy to just do the recruiting and backfilling. And anyway, so interesting. I thought it was a wacky idea that there'd be more robotics, but...
But the other issue, of course, because these companies have to deal with unions,
yes.
And unions aren't necessarily keen in seeing jobs replaced by robots, of course.
Of course.
So this friction, I guess, between management and workers is real. So it's not just about getting migrant workers doing the job, but it's about replacing humans. Yes, some jobs can be replaced by robots, which is why CERB is an interesting social experiment, because in the Silicon Valley, they've argued for many years, well, robotics are inevitable and AI is inevitable. So we'll need to think about people who are going to lose jobs as a result of making our economy more efficient using more robots. So why not pay people to stay home for a while, a guaranteed income? That's how it got argued in the Silicon Valley, saying that a guaranteed basic income is inevitable eventually just because of robotics. And COVID is kind of making a case for that, but at the same time, of course, we're also seeing many people wanting to go back to what we had before. And, you know, do we have the right system in place? But also, it boils down to price as well. I mean, the economics of food at retail are going to change. It's going to cost more to feed ourselves.
And
so up the food chain, perhaps there'll be more wealth, and companies like Cargill, GBS, and Maple Leaf will think about the market very differently.
Well, it just highlights the intersecting nature of culture, society, the economics, and the food business, right? It's really just core to everything. So it's a great discussion.
Absolutely.
We started talking about robots and meat processing plants, and we wound up at the... you know, a living wage and minimum wage.
I do think that, Michael, overall, that the social contract we have with the food industry is being redefined as a result of COVID.
So interesting.
I do believe that there is space for other types of models. I don't know what they are, but I do see space. A fragmented market is always a good one, especially when it comes to innovation.
Let's talk about grocery e-commerce. So it's not news to anyone, certainly wouldn't be news to you, that grocery e-commerce has just grown off the charts. You know, Carl Boutet, a great retail strategist, has called this all the great acceleration, you know, a trend that was going to happen anyway. It's just been accelerated a number of years. But the million, billion-dollar question is, will it stick, right? So we've gone from whatever percent was, you know, 1.5, maybe 2%, online transactions for grocery up to, you know, some estimates high as 10% and 15%. Do you think that was just kind of an opinion? Do you think that's a short-term phenomenon, or do you think the waterline will settle out higher, but it won't stay at the same intensity? What's your perspective on that?
It's a good question. I would say There's going to be a lot of investments. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, Sobeys made its Ocado partnership official. Mm-hmm. It's in operation. You're seeing more clicks and collects out there all over the place, which is really a model that provides convenience to both the retailer and consumers. I've never believed that the click and collect model is sustainable. Over the long term, I do expect people to go online more and get their food delivered at home. And we are getting older, and people are getting, well, addicted to buying online. I mean, in fact, we ran a survey a few weeks ago showing that 64% of Canadians have actually ordered food online or have tried to order food online for the first time since the start of the pandemic.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people.
That's a sudden change of behaviors, right? This habit that's just, you know, as I've described it, it's a big circuit breaker of habits, right? Suddenly you're doing something completely different.
And the big issue, of course, is who's going to pay for delivery. And again, going back to food inflation, because the needle is moving and the era of cheap food is probably going to come to an end at some point over the next couple of years. Instead of spending 9% of your budget on food, you'll probably be spending 11-12% even in a couple of years. Then all of a sudden that last mile, covering that last mile, becomes less obvious for consumers. So there's probably an opportunity for retailers to, you know, embed the cost into the price of food and cover the cost for delivery.
It's interesting because that's what Costco does. When you go to the Costco site, the pantry products are more expensive on the site than they are in the store. And, you know, they've got a threshold free shipping, but if you compare like for like, it's like $3 more an item. So it basically charges a surcharge for shopping online. You know, I'm more optimistic. I don't know if that's the right word, or sanguine about click and collect. I've been talking to retailers of different formats, not grocery, this week, and they all say that customers love curbside pickup. So to me, you know, consumers across Canada are suddenly doing curbside pickup. They don't want to go in the store. And then they found, holy, this is really convenient. I just pull up, somebody throws in my trunk and I leave. This is great. I think I'm more optimistic now that click and collect will catch on like a wildfire than I was, you know, 2 months ago.
Well, to act as the devil's advocate, COVID is happening in the spring. People don't mind getting out, but once in the fall, late fall, in the winter, curbside pickup may not be seen as appealing. Or if you have a chronic disease, or if you're sick,
sure.
Or if you can't get out, I mean, the delivery aspect is so convenient. Absolutely,
I think what you're going to see, and I'll leave it here, you're going to see retailers build enclosures. And you've already seen some build it that way so that they make it weather agnostic, so to speak. In other words, you pull in, it's like a drive through. It's like, you know, you go in, it's temperature controlled, it's all good. Now you still got to drive through whatever, you know, weather it takes to get there. But, you know, I think we're going to keep an eye on this one. I want to ask you this same question.
We're still in Canada. We're still not good at it. We're learning as we go along. And I suspect in a couple of years from now, we'll see a few retailers, Canadian retailers, do a better job at serving a customer that just doesn't want to actually spend time in the store.
Well, you know what?
Because there'll be more of them.
Well, I think that is the most interesting point, because in retail, time on task is one thing, but volume is the other. So if you're doing a click and collect once a day, your people don't get good at it, right? Because they, you know, but if you're doing it nonstop, volume solves a lot of sins, in other words. And you get good at it because you just practice. Like, you know, how do you get to Carnegie Hall, right? Practice. Last thing, I want to know if something fishy is going on here. Canadian government commits $470 million to the fisheries. Now, last episode, we talked about how much was given to agriculture. So first of all, I wanted to ask you, when we think of agriculture and fisheries, how relatively big is each of those in Canada? So I guess agriculture is both grains and pulses and also livestock, and then you've got the fishery. First of all, tell us how big each of those is in Canada, And then give us your feeling, is 470 million versus, I think, what was it, 322 or some number. They seem to have received more. Is that proportionate to the size of the industry? And just give me your thoughts about this this latest decision by the Canadian government.
Something fishy. Yeah, that's a good pun. I would say, is it proportionate? I don't think it is. I don't have the numbers on hand here, but I would say that I suspect that the Liberal government was trying to serve regions where people have no options. I mean, it's either fisheries or you just do nothing.
Right.
And so there are a lot of people who just don't have any options, and they needed the help. The one thing that makes me a little bit uncomfortable, given what happened to agri-food, like land-based agri-food versus sea or fisheries, is that most of the products coming out of the fisheries and seafood sector are exported in Canada. People don't realize it, but it's a very export-oriented sector. 85-90% of everything we produce in Canada is exported, and everything we consume in Canada is imported, most of it. And so we have public money supporting an industry for exports. And I think that's something to think about. Whereas land-based got $252 million, and a lot of that food is produced for Canadians.
That's interesting.
But nobody has raised this point up until now.
It's so interesting. So what you're doing is subsidizing people in some ways, not industries.
Exactly. And I think that was the intent of the government. It had nothing to do with the commodity. It had more to do with rural communities, which is, of course, a very strong argument as well.
You can imagine with a name like LeBlanc, I watch the lobster industry closer than most.
I suspect so, yeah. I'm in Halifax, so yeah, we're surrounded by it.
What a topsy-turvy world they've had, right? You know, Americans aren't shipping lobster to China, so Canadian fishers were the big beneficiaries, and now nothing's going anywhere. So there's just, I mean, I imagine the price of lobster is just dropping, which, you know, on the one hand.
It's at around $4 a pound right now.
So I think that's, I mean, how do you put a boat in the water at $4 a pound, right? I guess is the question.
But this is the weird part, Michael. They're still out there fishing, knowing that there's no market for it. That's the Canadian way. It's the build it, they will come sort of philosophy, instead of applying a demand chain management philosophy where you focus on the consumer and then you build an architecture, you build an industry based on what the market is looking for. We've done things the other way around in Canada all the time. Supply side economics.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Listen, lots more to talk about. We've had a great episode, and let me just say that's a bacon wrap on this episode. and listen, a shout out. I want to give a shout out to the hardworking farmers raising livestock and keeping the nation fed.
Absolutely.
You know, we're going to have special guests starting on the podcast, and we're going to get a farmer on the podcast, because often people talk farm.
Yeah, I'm looking
pork
forward to that.
You know, they talk pork, but they never talk to the farmer. So I want to make sure that we're speaking to the farmers. If you liked what you heard today, you can subscribe on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. Please rate and review. Be sure to recommend to a friend or colleague in the grocery, food service, or restaurant industry. I'm Michael LeBlanc, producer and host of the Voice of Retail podcast and a bunch of other stuff. And
I'm Sylvain Charlebois.
Well, thanks, everyone. Have a safe day, safe week. And Sylvain, I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
All right. Bye-bye.